On Monday, July 1st, we tossed around the question of whether or not we're overreacting to the use of e-cigarettes, even by teens. We were joined by former Republican State Senator Len Suzio of Maryland, who's still keeping an eye on the state's early release program for prisoners. And we checked in with Patrick Sasser from NoTollsCT.org. He updated us on where the fight over tolls stands. Any shop, well, I shouldn't say any shop, but just about any shop in and about Greater Bridgeport, Fairfield County, anywhere you go, you can buy e-cigarettes. Now, we're trying to clamp down on the use across the country here in Connecticut, raising the age as we did here to 21, but you can buy the e-smokes. You can get your favorite flavor of liquid nicotine. I'm into the raspberry myself. No, I'm kidding. I don't vape. I don't e-cig. Do nothing of that. I've actually never smoked a cigarette in my life, you believe that? But there are people who are still confused over this thing. And now we have, well, somebody here, I guess, who's going to point out a bit of hypocrisy. Julie Gunlock joins us. She's the director of the Independent Women's Forum Center for Progress and Innovation. And one of her books, this is great, I love this, From Cupcakes to Chemicals, How the Culture of Alarmism Makes Us Afraid of Everything and How to Fight Back. Julie Gunlock is with us. Hi, Julie. Paul in Bridgeport. Thanks for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Hey, Julie, I noticed the piece you wrote about e-cigarettes. And, you know, we're kind of beating our brow and beating our breasts now about how e-cigarettes now are somehow the worst thing on God's green earth.
Right.
It's like e-cigarettes are going to cause the second coming of the Messiah.
Right.
E-cigarettes are going to cause an asteroid to hit us. And you point out something here from a former high-ranking official who is trying to, I guess, kind of play both sides on this, leaving us all a tad bit confused, correct?
Yes, that's right. Former FDA Commissioner Scott Gottlieb, who now has a position at Pfizer, and he has a position at a very prominent Washington, D.C. think tank, so he's doing well for himself post FDA, but when he was at the FDA, he dismissed e-cigarettes and really tried to stoke the fears of e-cigarettes. He barely talked about the fact that e-cigarettes are 95% safer than traditional combustible cigarettes, and I'm talking about the cigarettes everyone remembers when they were a child, and now less and less being used, mainly because of e-cigarettes. So e-cigarettes are 95% safer. Over in the UK, in fact, doctors recommend smokers switch to vaping because it is so much safer. It doesn't release the number of chemicals. It's a very small amount of chemicals that are in the vapor that you breathe in, as opposed to 3,000 chemicals that are released when you actually burn the tobacco, which creates the tar, which goes into your lungs and therefore causes the cancer. Vaping doesn't do this. And so what's so sad is you've seen a ton of fear-mongering. There's no evidence that vaping causes any kind of lung disease or heart disease, and yet we have actually more hysteria about vaping. In fact, in San Francisco, they banned e-cigarettes entirely within the city limits.
How do you do that?
San
Francisco, listen, beautiful city, and if you like to defecate on the street, I guess that's where you go. But, you know, been there a couple times, but there's a city, I don't understand, Julie, you have a city that it costs like $100,000 to live in to get a studio apartment, like a 200-square-foot studio, and it's a city run by idiots.
Yeah, it's a city run by idiots, but it's not just that. What's so sad, particularly about San Francisco, is San Francisco is the city that invented harm reduction. They were the first city, for instance, to promote needle exchanges, condom distribution, methadone clinics. These are obviously, you know, the thought being that if you give people methadone, it's not great, but it's less harmful than heroin.
Mm-hmm.
If you give people condoms, yes, I that's not the best solution, but it's one solution to prevent the spread of AIDS. And with needle exchanges, we don't want people shooting up, but at least give them a clean needle to prevent the spread of these diseases. So they actually invented harm reduction, and here you have pretty much the perfect harm reduction vehicle for nicotine delivery, a product that mimics smoking. It looks like smoking, it feels like smoking, and it It delivers the nicotine, yet far less harmfully, and they banned it. It's just a real head-scratcher.
In this case with e-cigarettes, but generally the hypocrisy that goes on, and Julie, right, I mean, you have this hypocrisy where it's like, hey, my advocacy and my opinions, well, they're out for bid. I can run an organization and say, you know, something is really, really bad. And then when I leave and I get my golden parachute and run another organization, well, maybe it wasn't as bad as when I was over on the other side.
Well, what's so galling about Gottlieb's piece in the Wall Street Journal, which he wrote last week, saying there really should be a nuanced regulatory path for e-cigarettes? Well, dude, you're the head of the regulatory agency overseeing this, and you did not for several years, and you did nothing to create a regulatory path that was more nuanced. It's just so galling that this guy leaves the agency and then says, hey, there have to be changes at the agency, when he didn't in any way try to institute those changes. So, you know, I'm very frustrated, and I have been frustrated with Gottlieb for years. And one of the main reasons is that I am a mother of three children. Mm-hmm. One is approaching his tween years, which makes me need to take
good
a drink
luck.
Right now.
Good luck.
Yeah. But, you know, I don't want my kid vaping. But what really irritates me is Scott Gottlieb and all the folks in this anti-tobacco industry have really stoked fears of a teen vaping epidemic. And what it annoys me is that you actually look at the CDC data. If there's no such thing as a teen vaping epidemic, yes, kids try things and they experiment, but the habitual teen vaping numbers, it's 5%. Now, I don't like that. I don't think 5% is great. But when you talk to the people at the FDA, they act like every single teen is vaping, and that's not true. Their numbers include kids who try it maybe once a month, you know, look cool at a party.
Yeah.
It also includes 18 and 19-year-olds. Those are teenagers. And it also includes things like marijuana cigarettes and hookahs and other things that aren't e-cigarettes. So the numbers are totally jumbled. And yet Scott Gottlieb and the anti-tobacco folks took advantage of those numbers and really, again, stoked the fears of an epidemic that doesn't exist.
And, you know, Julie Gunlock is the guest. Julie, you mentioned 18 and 19-year-olds there. Last time I checked, unless the country flipped itself between this past Friday and as we talk here at 2:40 Eastern time on Monday, 18 and 19-year-olds are adults, right?
They can sign up to go into the military. They can do a whole heck of a lot of stuff. And this is what we're getting at here is that these folks like Scott Gottlieb and the anti-vaping zealots out there don't want you doing anything that could be perceived in any way as any way harmful. Now, they really are focusing on nicotine. Look, on the scale of things to be addicted to, I mean, we're talking fentanyl to heroin to, you know, whatever. I mean, nicotine is not that bad. It's kind of like coffee. It's like caffeine. It heightens your heart rate. It makes you more alert in some ways. Some people think that's not such a bad thing. I'm not saying that nicotine addiction is good, but let's all put it in perspective here, okay?
Yeah.
And if we're trying to regulate a product out of business to sort of save the kids, and what we're doing ultimately, though, is taking a life-saving product away from lifetime smokers who've had a lot of luck smoking using vaping products.
Hey, call me cynical here, Julie, and I'm sure this has crossed your mind as well. To me, and I've known people, right, like you have, obviously.
Yeah.
I have two or three very good friends who were habitual smokers. I mean, constant, probably at least a pack a day. I have two or three friends, all of whom have either stopped smoking or have severely cut back to on real cigarettes because they vape. And again, as you say, it's not a wonderful thing, but they admit, hey, at least I'm not, you know, making love to a tailpipe here.
I have very good friends who've literally quit smoking because of vaping. One of the most interesting things that I've learned in my research is that vaping or e-cigarette use is particularly important for women.
Yes.
Women neurobiologically do not react to patches and gum like men do, and they need different products. What I am begging out there, what I am begging people to do is not take away these products that help particularly women, but all people quit smoking. People who are trying to quit smoking, they try for years, they fail, and it's so discouraging, and meanwhile they're killing themselves. We really have to have a vast number of products on the marketplace so people have a choice and can find the product that helps them quit. An e-cigarette helps a huge demographic of people, and particularly women.
You know, you just mentioned, Julie, things like the patch the nicotine gum and got an old radio boss of mine, a guy, love him to death. I still see him. But, man, this guy kept the nicotine gum business going single-handedly. But, the again, the cynic in me, forgive me because I'm a radio talk show host. The cynic in me says, let's see, maybe when he was at the FDA, he was looking out for certain folks who might be saying, hey, we make this nice, expensive nicotine gum and all this stuff, you know, come down hard on those e-cigs because they're really cheap.
Well, you're absolutely right. Look, we know the federal government constantly chooses winners and losers. There is crony capitalism. Even in this situation in Seattle, you want to know who's the happiest about this ban of e-cigarette, Juul, an e-cigarette. You know who's the happiest of these bans on these products? It's big tobacco, because guess what's still legal? Guess what's still legal? So, you know, these people fighting against big tobacco just gave big tobacco a big, juicy, wet kiss by banning what is so competitive, dangerously competitive to the tobacco industry. Tobacco smoking in this country, and remember, e-cigarettes do not contain tobacco. So traditional combustible cigarettes in this country is at an historic low, and that includes teens. And most of that is not because of taxes and government intervention. It is because of the innovation of e-cigarette products that have given people an alternative. Smokers don't want to kill themselves. They are thrilled to have this alternative. And here you have government trotting in and ruining the day. It's so typical.
And it's amazing, Julie, that, and again, I kind of can see it and I can't. It's just like smoking, the use of e-cigarettes, shall I say, is now, as far as anti-smoking areas, where you can smoke, it's up there with tobacco. And to me, I understand the reaction of people, but from a purely logical standpoint and scientific standpoint, it's ludicrous. It's not smoke. It's water vapor.
It's
water vapor.
It is, but this is the problem. It is both the success and the death of e-cigarettes that it so closely mimics cigarettes. When I talked about women not neurobiologically reacting to cigarettes, they found in multiple studies and actually in brain scans that women need something more than just the nicotine, because women do not have as many nicotine delivery receptors in their brain. So when they take a puff of smoke, they don't respond like men do, where their whole brain lights up. What women actually need is the hand-to-mouth contact, the deep breathing. They need the habit-forming quality that comes with smoking. That's what they miss when they give it up. So if you give them an e-cigarette, they can kind of mimic those, the hand-to-mouth, the holding something in their hand. Also, there's appetite-suppressing qualities of that. And so women really need the actual feel and act of smoking more than the patch and the nicotine. But this is why the anti-smoking people are now really lobbing onto nicotine, because they don't have the, you know, dangerous chemicals going into your lungs, and they can't scream cancer, because it's pretty much proven that e-cigarettes don't cause cancer or any kind of lung diseases. So it's a really really difficult issue here, but I think we have to remember that e-cigarettes really serve a population that has been desperate for new products in the marketplace.
Julie, I find it amazing that there are people still living on the earth, because you would think that our parents, our grandparents, our great-grandparents would all be dead from all the stuff that we are now supposed to be afraid of. I mean, I will freely admit here, okay, we'll do an intervention here. I drank from the garden hose.
Oh, God.
I rode my bicycle without a helmet and fell off numerous times. Julie, how am I still here?
I have seen children in my neighborhood. Now, I live outside. I live on the East Coast, too, with knee pads on as they're riding your bike. So not just a helmet. I mean, it's only a matter of time before kids start walking around in hazmat suits. and that's actually what I've called it. It's no longer helicopter parenting. It's hazmat parenting. You are constantly afraid that your child is going to be exposed to some sort of, like, chemical or something in the air or the water. I mean, look, our water and air is cleaner and safer than ever before. People are living longer than ever before. You know, our lives have become so incredibly easy compared to even what my grandmother had. My grandmother, you know, I often think about this. And this is why I wrote the book. When I had my children, my oldest is 12, so 12 years ago when I had my child, I was suddenly being told that I had to be afraid of everything. And what was interesting is I had served as a staff member on the Homeland Security Committee, had received some, you know, some briefings that kind of scared me. And so I felt by the time I'd quit that job to have children, I felt like I was a pretty tough person, and I was aware of the world's truly scary things. And then suddenly I was being told that, like, I had to worry about the soap I was using, like that baby soap wasn't safe, or that, you know, I had to worry about, you know, oh my God, is that vegetable a GMO? And, you know, all this, it was crazy. And so I really wanted to reassure moms and remind them of the past. If you read one history book.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
You know, Julie, I'm in the middle of reading or listening to an audiobook on Babe Ruth and the description of Baltimore. Oh my God. It was making me nauseous just listening to it. And I'm saying to myself, and you hear this stuff and you go, wow, it's amazing how essentially, yeah, we still have problems, but essentially how clean living is today. And you go back to that era or even a little up from that with our grandparents or anywhere in some area, you know, some areas had open sewage. There's some sewage in the street. Yeah. And like nobody cared.
When I give quite a few public speeches, and when I talk to particularly groups of women, I always start off by talking about a census that was done in 1900 of the Hell's Kitchen section of New York City.
Yeah, now, Manhattan.
Nowadays, the Hell's Kitchen section is a great place to see a comedy show and get great ramen. But back in 1900, it was tenement housing. It was 20 people stuffed into a room, no sewer, proper sanitation and sewer, and no real concept of germ therapy. So there was a census done, and they found that every week, so once a week, every single week in 7 days, 1,500 babies died in the Hell's Kitchen area of
New York City.
Isn't that amazing? And today, women are afraid of Doritos. I mean, it is astonishing to me.
I know.
And this is why we have a thriving anti-vax movement. Haven't just eradicated these diseases, we've eradicated the memory of what it was like to lose a child before 1 year. We have eradicated the idea of a child being put in an iron lung. And, you know, we have an incredibly good food system. And yet, if you read Michael Pollan or any of these other alarmists, oh my God, our food system is broken.
Oh,
and
please.
Our agriculture system is
don't
broken.
Get me going. Please, two things, Julie. Don't get me going on two things. And I have arguments with this with wonderful friends of mine, men and women.
Yeah.
But two things. First of all, gluten free. Stop with the gluten. Gluten. If you have celiac disease, yes, that's an issue. But you don't have to eat gluten free peaches because you know what I mean. Some of the most idiotic. Hey, eat this. It's gluten free. Thank you.
Marketing.
Oh, and the other one, Julie, that kills me. Non-GMO. We've been genetically modifying foods in this country for 50 years.
Yep. And the animal feed. Look, animals. There was a seminal study a couple of years ago where they analyzed the data of billions and billions of animals have got. You know, because a lot of the GMO corn goes to feed the
cows. Yeah, exactly.
And not one sniffle, not one infected hoof. Nothing. These animals are safe. We are safe.
Know why they say that, Julie, don't you? you know why that is? Big pharma's
that's
buying
right.
them off. Yeah.
That's right.
You know there's a cure for cancer.
But you're right. You've just nailed the exact thing you're talking about. There's a fear of big. So big food, big ag, big pharma, big sugar, everything. Everything's a conspiracy. It's a lot of conspiratorial thinking in this country, and we really got to back that off, because otherwise we've got a voting block that's going to really go for regressive policies and outlaw things like e-cigarettes, which is tremendous progress and innovation, and we should be celebrating it.
You know, Julie, we ran a family grocery store here in Connecticut in New Haven, and my father ran it for years and years, mainly an Italian grocery store. And you know what, Julie? Everything we sold, the cold cut, high fat, high salt, very heavy oils. I mean, nothing. And every one of our customers, almost to a person, was rail thin. They bought $100 of stuff from us every week, but you know, and they all lived to their upper 80s and early 90s. You know why? They were active every day. They weren't tied behind desks and computer monitors. They were working on the streets, typical Italian immigrants. They were building, you know, concrete, asphalt, you know, and these people used to, you know, come to our store covered in construction dust.
Of course.
And they lived till they were like 85 and 90.
Of course, of course. I mean, you think about, you know, I have talked to my children about trade schools and jobs and trades and what jobs make more money, and I will be proud of them if they decide to be an electrician or a plumber or something that's, I, you know, that really teaches them a skill. You know, I think that's my why I always joke around, micro 2020.
Like, because God forbid we borrow student loan money, you know.
Right, of course.
Anyway, Julie, it's, listen, we're running out of time. It's been great. Julie Gunlock is the director of the Independent Women's Forum's Center for Progress and Innovation. Check out the book, From Cupcakes to Chemicals, How the Culture of Alarmism Makes Us Afraid of Everything and How to Fight Back. Julie, please, I'm begging you, nothing non-GMO tonight or gluten-free. Really.
It's probably going to be a frozen pizza.
Oh, beautiful, beautiful. Make sure that back of the package, the ingredient thing is like 3 inches long. Thanks, Julie.
I'm
appreciate
it. Reading it. Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks. Appreciate it right there, Julie Gunlock. Joining us right now, old buddy of mine, former Republican state senator of Meriden, former, maybe future, you never know, Len Susio joins us. Are you running again, Len? How are you?
I don't want to say anything in front of my wife, so I'll just be, I won't answer that question.
So you don't, wait. You're not gonna, so you're saying you would tell my audience, but the wife is the one who's got the final arbitration on this.
Paul, we just celebrated our 48th anniversary.
I saw that. 48 years. God bless the two of you, Len. 48 years.
Oh. Yes. And I have to say, I was, I look back on 48 years of marriage with my wife. And
yeah.
If anything, I was wrong about her in the sense that I underestimated how good she is.
Oh, isn't that nice?
That to me is, the thing that attracted me to her was, of course, the looks initially.
Of course.
But when I got to know her, I said, "Wow, this woman is,
now this is good, huh? I better not."
And you know what?
I better not
underestimate how good she was.
I better not screw this up, is what you're saying.
No.
All right, well, folks, for you here at WICC who haven't heard Len before, I've known him for years, former Republican state senator, multi-terms in and out from the 34th district in Maryland. Did I get the number right, Len? Is it 34?
No, it's 13.
13. Yeah, all these numbers are so confusing. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
But Len, I know you've been keeping an eye on two issues for me. Before we get to tolls, you were still keeping an eye on the controversial early release program that was instituted under former Governor Daniel Malloy. And you really, whether you're in the legislature or out of it, you've really been keeping tabs on some of the rather dangerous folks that are being released on the streets. What's the latest, Len? What have you heard? And what's the process of you being able to get some of these numbers that you have to battle over?
Well, if anything, I begin by saying the term rather dangerous seriously understates the real threat and the danger that's here. You know, we're talking about people who have criminals who've committed some of the most horrendous crimes, getting out of prison months and sometimes years ahead of schedule for participating in this early release program. And, you know, I started fighting it when one of the very first crimes committed by an early release criminal was committed in my hometown of Meriden. Ibrahim Ghazal, a store owner, a 70-year-old store owner, was murdered in cold blood by Frankie the Razor Resto. It was on videotape. You know, the security cameras had it. There's no doubt who did it. And he should have, Resto, Frankie the Razor Resto, should have been in prison at that point in time, except he had been let loose about 200 days early because of this program.
And this guy was no Resto, folks. And they may remember the case, Len, with Mr. Ghazal and his family being just scarred by this. But, you know, Resto was no, he was no first-time offender here. This guy's a bad guy.
Oh, no, and they knew he was bad. They knew he was bad. The Undersecretary for Criminal Justice, Mike Lawler, at the time, who was the architect, by the way, of the early release program, when interviewed Mike Lawler extensively. I was state senator at that time, and I asked him, why did you let Resto go? And he said to me, they had to let him go for time served because of all the early release credits he accumulated, even though they knew he was a violent criminal. He had set his jail cell on fire. He was involved with gangs and drugs and everything else. In fact, he failed his drug test only a few weeks before he murdered Ghazal. So they were forced by the law to let him go, even though they knew he was dangerous. And I wish I could say, Paul, that this was the exception to the rule. But what I've been doing, and you know this ever since, I've been getting information from the Department of Correction. Every 6 months, they upload to me a database on all the inmates that are in Connecticut prison or have been released. And I've identified over 15,000 violent crimes. I'm not talking about picking somebody's pocket or something kind of innocuous like possession of 2 ounces of marijuana or something like that. I'm talking about people who committed violent crimes, murder, rape, sexual assaults of all sorts, have been committed by these criminals after they have been discharged from prison under the so-called early release program. And the whole idea of the early release program is, oh, supposedly we're reforming the lives of these criminals, and that's the justification for letting them out of prison early. But after 7 years now, going on 8 years, we've had enough experience with the program to know unequivocally it has failed at least 15,000 times. You go ask any one of those victims of those crimes whether they think the program succeeded in rehabilitating a criminal. And I guarantee you the poll will be 100% failure. No way it's reformed. And this is a dangerous experiment that unfortunately has resulted in thousands of Connecticut citizens being harmed by it. And by the way, I'm talking not only about adult male and females, but even young children. There have been 800 sexual crimes committed against children by these criminals who have been let loose from prison early as well.
And you're not, and these aren't, Len, we should stop and let people know here that these aren't, you claim these aren't projections here. These are cold, hard stats that I know it took you a while to gain access to, but now you have them and you have these documented, correct?
Absolutely. I can tell you the name of any criminal who's committed one of these 15,000 crimes I'm talking about. And I can tell you when they committed it and when they were readmitted to prison. This is not guessing. It's not projecting. It's actually what's happened. And I get phone calls from local police authorities from time to time asking me if a criminal they just apprehended for some kind of a crime was an early release prisoner.
So wait, they're calling you to check and see if a guy they just collared for something was out on early release?
Yes. I've been called by local law enforcement officials about this on a number of occasions.
Do you know now we have a new governor, we have a new corrections commissioner, we have a new
from Idaho.
We have the guy from Idaho. Ned Lamond is now the governor. Mm-hmm. We have Mike Lawler, who's moved on now to an academic role, I believe. Do we foresee, Len, any changes in this program coming up?
Well, there was legislation introduced in this past session that would have added about 6 new crimes that would have been ineligible for early release, including assault of a pregnant woman resulting in the death of her child, assault of elderly persons, first degree sexual assault, and the legislature refused to act on it. The Democratic-controlled legislature has more sympathy for the criminals rather than the victims, unfortunately. And the crimes we're talking about, Paul, are really egregious crimes. And we just said, look, at least in these cases, protect the public and show some sense of justice. I've been called numerous times by women whose testimony have put criminals behind bars for sexual assault. And they are incredibly anxious about their own safety when they find out that their sexual assailant is being let loose from prison years ahead of schedule. They're fearful for their own safety. There's no sense of justice in this at all, and there's no protection of the community. It's a get out of jail pass designed to save Connecticut money in our prison system. That's why they've been, bragging about the prison population being down.
And Linda, you were going to touch on the subject that I try to explain to people all the time before we have the break there, that the reason the prison population is lower here in Connecticut is essentially because we're letting more people out of jail. Some of these folks, you contend, and a lot of folks say, should not be getting out early at all.
Yeah, since September of 2011, when the early release program was first implemented through December of last year, December of 2018, there were about 43,000 prisoners discharged from Connecticut prisons under the early release program. They got out of prison early because of this. That's one of the major reasons why the prison population is down. We also decriminalized certain acts that had been considered to be serious crimes regarding drugs and particularly marijuana. And I'm not saying that was that in that case was necessarily a bad thing, but the whole point is that we were we decriminalized activity before that had been considered criminal before. So that itself also has been a reason for the prison population being lower. So I wish I could tell you it was a reflection on Connecticut being a safer place.
Yeah.
But if anything, I think Connecticut is more dangerous than ever because we are letting these people out. And again, Paul, I could see if we had just a year's experience, maybe this is an experiment. Let's see if it works. But now we've had 7 going on 8 years of experience. And as I pointed out, I can give people the list of 15,000 violent crimes. And I'm not counting the thousands of other crimes committed by these criminals who have been discharged from prison early. I counted in that 15,000 only the ones that are the most serious, the most violent.
The prison rate
is about 2 to 1.
It's frustrating, Len, because so many people just don't know this happens. I mean, because, mm-hmm. again, you've been in the General Assembly a couple of times. It's mm-hmm. not, and I don't use this in a flip way, Len, it's not a sexy issue. The budget is mm-hmm. sexy. Tolls are sexy. Mm-hmm. medical marijuana, recreational marijuana. But mm-hmm. when you tell people this stuff, Len, and I'm sure this has happened to you when you explain how many people are getting out early that shouldn't be getting out. These aren't guys and gals who are model prisoners here and they're just, mm-hmm. they're really rehabilitated. I'm sure when you tell folks this, they're somewhat surprised.
Oh, yeah. And again, Paul, if you look at the numbers, 15,000, well, okay, that amounts to 6 violent crimes being committed every day since the program began by early release criminals. Because in roughly 7 years, we're talking about 2,500 days. It's a little more than that. I don't have my computer in front of me. And with 15,000 violent crimes, you're talking that's about 6 violent crimes every day. I calculated that every roughly 7.3 days, there's either a rape or a murder committed by one of these inmates that have been discharged from prison early. If that isn't testimony, damning testimony that should end this program, or at least modify it so that the more violent criminals stay in jail for their full term, then, something's wrong.
You were pilloried, Len, by, the criminal justice people. Mike Lawler made no secret about his dislike, not maybe for you personally, but from what you were doing. It's no secret you said that one of your defeats in a reelection bid was backed strongly by the governor's office. Mm-hmm. Do you still have a bullseye on you for what you're doing here or not?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I lost last year because I was targeted by some special interest groups who don't like my conservative politics. And they spent upwards of $250,000 to beat me in my state Senate campaign.
That's a ton of money in a state Senate campaign. That's a huge amount of money.
It's a record, basically. Unbelievable.
Yeah, yeah. So, Len, let me shift gears here in about the last 3 minutes we have with you here. Let's go from the recidivism rates here to tolls. And again, it looks like, obviously, we're not going to get the special session in July for tolls. They've got other things. What are you hearing now, Len? I'm hearing maybe in the fall and maybe never there may be just too many squishy Democrats here who are going to throw their arms up and say, well, we just don't have the votes. What are you hearing?
I'm hearing the same thing. There's about 8 senators in the Senate, 8 Democrats, I should say.
Really?
Who 4 who have indicated they're pretty much against the tolls unless they're for trucks only, and 4 who are sitting on the fence. Now, the legislature is 36 senators, and there's 14 Republicans and 22 Democrats. So the Democrats need to get 18 votes. And, of course, if they have 22 senators and 4 are definitely against it and 4 are sitting on the fence, they need to get all 4 of the 4 sitting on the fence. to get to the 18-18 tie, and the lieutenant governor in that case would cast a tie-breaking vote, which I'm certain she would vote for tolls in a jiffy. So, you know, the tolls, we don't have time to really get into it.
I know, chair
the Transportation Committee.
Yeah.
I know the issue like the back of my hand. Maybe one these days
sure.
soon you and I could have a more in-depth discussion about that. But I can tell you that we can't let up. I'm working with the No Tolls Connecticut people, the notollct.org
yep.
People. I urge people to go to their website. And we're doing a door-to-door campaign in some of those districts of the senators who are sitting on the fence.
Well, yeah, Lennon,
we're keeping an eye on
and them. I guess they're going to be going into an election year coming up in 2020 already. This two-year cycle really, as mm-hmm. you know, never ends. And I was told by a couple of people that, you know what, there's a real fear there if the Senate, I mean, the House is a different story. That's 31 mm-hmm. seats. But if the Senate goes for this, you know, that could flip the Senate to GOP control in 2020, and then none of the governor's programs would get through.
That's right, and I think that's what they're concerned about. You know, we can't let our guard down. I say to your listeners, if you have a chance, go to the notollct.org website, sign a petition if you haven't done so already, and by all means, call your state senator's office and your state representative's office and tell them you want them to vote against tolls. You don't be intimidated. You will not speak to the state senator or state rep. You'll end up talking to an aide or even mm-hmm. a voicemail.
Yeah.
But just leave a message. It makes a difference, Paul. It makes a big difference. If a state legislator gets a couple hundred phone calls, believe me, that has an impact. So
oh, absolutely.
I encourage your audience.
Sure, sure. And again, like I say, Len, when you call, don't scream and yell. Be respectful
yeah.
and just leave the message. Absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah.
Len, thanks so much. We appreciate it. Len Susio. Len, we'll have you back in a few weeks, and we'll get further into the toll issue. And also, if there's any news regarding the early release program, which, again, is not working, there are many more violent crimes, as you point out, that are committed. Any mm-hmm. more info on that, give me a call, okay?
Absolutely, Paul. We will keep you posted and up to date.
Thanks Len. Again, appreciate it. Len Susio, former 13th District Republican State Senator, who has run a couple of times, lost, run again, won, and he may run again. The number one guy who has done a fabulous job at putting the toll issue out front, Patrick Sasser from notollsct.org. Patrick, how are you? Paul here. How you doing?
I'm good, Paul. How are you?
Not too bad. Well, what's the latest here now? We had Len Susio on last hour, who said that he heard, Patrick, that there might be about four members of the state Senate who will only vote yes on this, perhaps, if it's not passenger cars and it's only trucks. And apparently there's little movement in the House, too. What are you hearing?
Yeah, well, I'm hearing the same thing from the best I can tell at this point in time. Now, look, things can change every day.
Mm-hmm.
We know how politics work. You know, they can cut a deal and behind closed doors, but as of the moment,
yeah.
the governor does not have the votes. And that is clear because obviously the session ended, they didn't bring it up. He had a meeting the other week with the House leaders, the Senate leaders, that seemed to fall flat. I just heard audio today of him at one of the rest areas that the governor has now opened up, and he was asked the question. It sounds like he's going to be having another meeting with leadership to try to talk tolls.
Mm-hmm.
It sounds like in the next week or so.
Okay.
And he's still talking about trying to hold a vote this session during a special session. He's talking before the end of July. So, you know, the best thing we can do and the best thing that the taxpayers can do that want to stop this from happening, get on our website, notollct.org. We have a simple link on there that'll show you exactly who your state rep and who your state senators are. And you people have to call them, email them. That is, from my understanding, that seems to be the most effective way of getting their attention, because if their constituents continue to call them and email them, that's what's keeping them from voting on tolls. So that's what we're encouraging all listeners, all of your listeners have to do that this week and just put pressure on them.
Yeah,
and that's how we're going to continue to win this fight.
Yeah, and Len Susio told us, too, that now the anti-toll forces are now going to, I guess, Patrick, you're some of the folks in various districts that could be a little squishy on this, squishy, rather, who could swing. There's going to be some door-to-door canvassing as well, correct?
That is correct, and we're asking folks to go to our website, join up as volunteers. We've already been organizing in some districts. Folks have been going out, knocking on doors, signing our petition, and we're giving them the paperwork that gives the phone number of their local rep and local senator. So we're attacking this full force.
Yeah.
You know, we're not giving up on this fight. We're continuing to get petition signatures on our website. I have folks that have been going to local fairs in different towns, districts, and they've been canvassing the events and getting people to sign the petitions. So we're definitely out there, and you know, that's how we're going to win this battle.
So you said there are still people signing petitions on this?
Absolutely, we're still gathering signatures. When I have another decent stack of signatures, I will present them again to the governor's office. I don't know what it is that he's not hearing from the masses, because I think it's very clear in any poll that's ever been taken, the people of Connecticut don't want tolls. And he still seems to be pushing this issue. So I think the reps and the senators are starting to get it, you know, that, you know, they have re-election next year.
Yeah.
And we're going to hold their feet to the fire. You know, they want to vote for this tax because that's what it is. A judge in Rhode Island ruled on it. Tolls are a tax. I don't, you know, the governor likes to use a user fee and things like that. It is a tax. So if they want to vote for something like that, they will pay the consequences next year when they're up for re-election.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why we're going to have their constituents put pressure on them.
Patrick Sasser, the guest from NoTollsCT.org. Now, Patrick, it's interesting that you said a couple of moments ago that you heard that he was still going to push for a vote as early as this month, because I was talking to Themis Claridis from Derby last week. She said that may be very difficult. It may go to August or September because the July special session, I guess the first thing they have to do, Patrick, is deal with certain things regarding bonding here, and then the toll vote may come. But again, that may be too close to an election year, as you said.
Correct. Yeah, no, that's what I heard in an audio that was done today. And again, every time the governor speaks in front of the media, the story always changes. So maybe he told them they plans on getting a vote done this month, but in reality, maybe it is August or September.
Mm-hmm.
Just don't see it happening. I think the lawmakers recognize that this is a super hot topic, and the public has really spoken out against it. I just don't see how he can muster up the votes. You know, he's already tried to offer different kinds of deals. He's talked about reducing the income tax slightly to give people like an $80 break on their income tax, yet you're going to pay maybe $600, $700, maybe $1,000 a year in tolls. So explain to me where the savings are.
Mm-hmm. No, it's simple math. No, Patrick, it ends up being simple math. And like I've said before, Patrick, and said to you, you know, this is not 1991 or 92 anymore, where the internet was in its infancy, and it was almost unheard of at that time to organize folks like you have done with just a website, nothing more than a website. Probably took you half an hour to set up. There you go. Register the domain as you did. You got it going. I wonder if you were around, Patrick, although with Lowell Weiger probably wouldn't have made a difference, but I wonder if you were around back in 91, 92 when the income tax, state income tax was formulated, you might have been able to stop that as well.
Well, I tell you, if I was old enough then, I would have definitely done everything I could to try to stop it. And you know what? And this is where we all go back to the word trust. When they tell us that, you know, toll money will be used for the highways and toll money will be used directly for bridges and all these things, it's very easy to go back to what you're saying in the early 90s to when they said income tax was only going to be temporary. Well, it's 2019 and we're still paying it.
Mm-hmm.
So this is where the trust has been broken with the government. This is where the taxpayers of Connecticut are fed up. We pay our fair share as it is. The problem is the people in Hartford just spend the money like it's water. And this is where we finally have to put our feet down and say we've had enough. And this is what this movement is all about. And this is where we're getting the attention of these lawmakers, saying you can't just continue to put tax on top of tax on top of tax, because who's going to be left in the state? Over 80 people a day are leaving Connecticut. Businesses now, you see it every week now, a new business announces they're moving, yeah. They're cutting back, or they're, you know, downsizing, or they're shipping out to another state that's more competitive. So how could 50 tolls make Connecticut more competitive and bring businesses in? I think they're going in the wrong direction. This governor, who I thought was going to have some business sense, clearly does not understand what it takes to make Connecticut more competitive. He seems to be doing the complete opposite.
You know, Patrick, as you well know, we don't have initiative and referendum here in this state. We don't. We're one of, I think, 11 states that cannot have ballot questions like marijuana and the death penalty and tolls. But, you know, Patrick, I got to tell you, I was thinking about this preparing for the show today. I think what you have done and what your no tolls forces have done, you know, really, Patrick, is about as close as we're going to be able to get to having initiative and referendum where people can, if not directly vote on something, really affect the way, and bless you, I didn't think it was possible, really affect the way, to move an issue away from or towards legislators to where you're telling them, if you do this, there will be a price to pay because we do not want this.
Right. And that's the whole thing with this. You know, when I got involved with fighting the tolls last year, when Governor Malloy was pushing for it, I knew this was going to be an uphill battle. I said, you know what, but I can't just sit still and let this all unfold, you know, and I just felt I had to step up and do something. And this year, obviously, with a new governor who seems to have the same ideas as Malloy, I couldn't back down, and more people got involved. And really what I'm hoping is people see that this is a spark, and this movement is a spark. If people feel that the other direction that the state is going in, or there's something else people think needs to change, you can step up. You can actually fight the state government. There is a way to make our voices heard, and I'm hoping that other people, you know, get energized or motivated by it and get involved, because, you know, I use a slogan now. It's called Save Our State. If we all don't step up to do it, what's going to be left of Connecticut? We're already ranked the second highest tax state in the country. So if the citizens don't start to literally revolt and speak out and put pressure on their lawmakers, this state is going to be dead. It's going to be over. There will be no businesses left.
Yeah,
so I really encourage people to take this as an opportunity to say, you know what, we can beat our government in Connecticut.
And part of the reason that's, I think, possible here, Patrick, with, you know, just media interviews and a website like yours, when you think about it, Connecticut has, well, let's see, you know, the 151 state reps and, 36 state Senate members. So you've got, what, 187 legislators in, you know, Patrick, a relatively small state to have almost 200 legislators. So because the breakdown of these districts is relatively small, any vote that you can shift on an issue like this has added impact.
Absolutely. And that's why we're encouraging people, make those phone calls, send those emails, because my understanding from talking to several lawmakers up there in Hartford, when I go up there, or I talk to some by the phone, they tell me, they say, Pat, even if 20, 30, even if 50 people of their voters, their constituents call them, that is a big number when it comes to voting day. They can't afford to lose those votes. So it makes a huge difference. Whether you're a Democrat, Republican, and you're calling your lawmaker, it makes a huge impact because they're paying attention to that. And that's why we've been encouraging people, you know, to get out there, make those calls. And the over 100,000 signatures
yeah.
that we submitted to the governor, you know, those are from districts from all over the state. And we have it broken down by different districts. And we've been sending that information to these reps and these senators. So, you know, they're getting the, they're feeling the heat. You know, this is not a topic that we're just going to walk away from and let happen. We're
sure.
going to fight this battle to the end.
And Pat, you know, I've said before on shows like this and others, I said, well, okay, Patrick Sasser's group has dropped off 100,000 signatures. Okay, let's say that even if 50,000 of those people say they're upset, but they're not going to change their vote, okay, factor those out. Well, you still have 40 to 50,000 people who may say, you know what, I'm going to base my vote on that. And Pat, 50,000 votes, not counting who
right.
may vote in their families, along
right.
with mom or dad or a son or a daughter on this, in a state the size of Connecticut, that's a cataclysmic number.
Absolutely. It makes a huge impact. And this is where the governor, I'm very shocked, is not paying attention to this. One, he didn't win by a lot of votes. Number two, his election will, you know, the campaign will be starting before we all know it. And this is a topic that he ran on, he campaigned on, made promises and made a pledge on one of the news channels, one of the TV shows, where he pledged he would not toll cars. 30 days into his administration, he completely flipped that.
Mm-hmm.
So even if people voted for him, they very, very likely, if this were to go through, could change their vote next go around and say, why am I going to vote for this guy? He lied to me, and now I'm paying another $800 a year in tolls. So, you know, the actions that these people take, we have to hold them accountable. You know, we're the ones that are footing the bill every time they come up with a new law or new regulation that's going to cost us taxpayers money. And this is where we need to speak out and be more vocal, get in touch with our lawmakers, and let them know that we're upset. We're not happy about the direction our state is going in.
Patrick, thank you. We'll be in touch down the road, my friend. Fight the good fight. Patrick Sasser there from NoTollsCT.org. Thanks, Pat. We'll talk to you.
Thank you, Paul. Take care.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Yep, Patrick Sasser there. And folks, that's what you think about it. I mean, I had a friend of mine the other day say, well, it's only 100,000 petition signatures. I said, yeah, but you have to understand something. It's 100,000 signatures, so even if you back 50,000 signatures out, okay, that's 50,000 other people who might be PO'd enough to change their votes. Do you know what a 50,000 vote swing would do in the General Assembly?